Hey, before we get started, I've got to tell you that I made a small mistake in my introduction to this interview. But before I even tell you about the mistake, I've got to tell you about my sponsors, right? The first sponsor is Grasshopper. Grasshopper is the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love because they can manage it all online and because it gives them all kinds of extensions and other features. Check out grasshopper.com for more. Second, Shopify.com. How many entrepreneurs have you seen here on Mixer do you talk about how they built successful, profitable e-commerce sites? Well, Shopify.com says if you want to do the same thing, within minutes you can be up and running with your own e-commerce site, with your own store online, within minutes. So check out Shopify.com. Finally, RichWP, you know that they're going to give you the theme for your website that doesn't just look great out of the box, but also is customizable, so you can make it look great the way you define great. And we've got an email here from the founder. He's saying that if you use the coupon code Mixergy, you're going to get 15% off themes, and you're also going to get, let me see what else, 2-for-1 special. So all kinds of discounts, limited time, you know the drill. All right, the drill is go check out richwp.com. Not much more than that. All right, the mistake that I made is this. I assumed that she raised her money within no time at all. It took her a lot longer and it was a lot harder, which means that there's a lot more for you to learn along the way. So listen to the full interview, hear how she raised money for her business, check out my sponsors, here's the interview. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And I've got with me today Laura Fitton. She is the founder of 140, an app store for Twitter. The business reportedly raised over $2 million in funding and now has about 2,000 Twitter apps listed on the site. But that's not why I invited you here, Laura. I love 140, and I'm going to be asking you about 140, what it is, and understanding the business behind it. But what I want to know is what got you here? Because Laura isn't somebody. You're not somebody who just had an idea one day for a website around Twitter, and boom, people showered you with money. No, you spent a long time building this reputation for yourself, building an audience for yourself so that people like me, when you launched your business on day one, were excited to see what did she create? What did Pistachio make? And then you established contacts and relationships that helped you get funding, that helped you get advisors like Guy Kawasaki. I want to know what you did to get here, because a lot of people would love to have this kind of launch, the kind that you had. So we're going to dig into that. We're going to dig into that. We're also going to understand more about what 140 is. Why don't we start off with a little more understanding what it is before we get to understand how we got here. So I explained that 140 is a Twitter app, an app store for Twitter. Let me ask you what the business model is behind the business.
Well, we're an open applications marketplace and a platform for developers to build their businesses on. So the most obvious one, you know, and I'm sort of sassy sometimes with investors, and they're like, what's your business model? I'm like, we're a store, we take money and we keep some of it. You know, that's the really simplistic one. There's obviously affiliate. We hope to be able to offer, you know, like a services tier. So if we can bundle business solutions that make it super easy to run the business end of running an app, you know, we're going to offer most of those for free, but some of them will probably be upsell if they're a cost to us. One thing that is not part of our business model is donations. We actually see donations as a cost center. We subsidize donations because we've seen too many great apps come and go in the last 3 years. People don't necessarily know enough to donate to support an app they like that's maybe just a hobby for the developer, but we at least try and encourage that. And to do it, we do 100% pass through any donations the developer gets, to the extent that we literally will pay the PayPal fee to make sure what little does come in goes straight to the people who are innovating.
Wow. Okay, so let's see if we understand this. I do a search, say I want to have a new app that I will tweet through. I want to find a Hootsuite. I do a search on the site, I find Hootsuite, I link over, no money exchanges hands. If I do a search for an app that I love, I get to tell all my friends that I love it, I get to add a comment underneath it so that strangers who are curious about it get to find out what makes this app so exciting. And if I want to donate to the app creator, I can, through you, donate to the app creator. You guys will not take a cut, never will take a cut of that donation. If anything, you'll actually pay the PayPal processing fees. And if I want an app that's like Zobni or Social 2, I think is on the homepage right now, those are paid apps. You guys will get a cut of that revenue.
Yeah. And it's totally up to the developer if they sell, where they sell, when they sell, how they sell. You're not tied to exclusivity selling through us. You don't pay for being listed on the site. You don't even pay for editorial control of your listing, which really makes us an advertising platform. That's all free. Things that you might pay for are if you choose to sell through us, then obviously we take a cut. If you choose to, you know, eventually we don't offer it now, but eventually we will offer premium placement on the site, so you can buy advertising inventory on the site or better positioning or top of search results clearly demarcated. We haven't rolled that out because we just think from a customer development standpoint, it's more important to get people in, see how they want to use an applications marketplace in Twitter's context. There's a lot about at Twitter that's so different from the App Store and the Apple ecosystem. We're really more in the learning phase with that, and we don't want to rush out, even though developers have wanted since we launched to be able to buy that premium placement. We don't want to confuse the end user. We want to discover what, you know, one of the things you and I search when we go to 140, I almost always search when I go there. Only 5% of visitors search. Most visitors browse, click, go through tags, go through categories. So we're watching the public. We thought at this point we'd have about 5,000 people still in a closed beta and be testing everything out. And just the way things went, and as lucky as we've been, we just blew it wide open and let everybody come in. So we're catching up. You know, the money we raised will be used to catch up with demand and roll out the services we can see people want, or we've heard that people want.
Okay. All right. You said that you've got 5,000 people in the beta.
Our goal. That was our intention. Mm-hmm. We have tens of thousands of users at this point.
Yeah. All right. And how long have you been in business?
I'm sorry?
How long have you been in business?
We launched the site September 23rd. We launched a very, very, very early developer-only prototype alpha July 17th. The first line of code was written May 11th, and the company was established March 31st. So this has all happened in like 9 months.
Okay, all right. People would kill to, in 9 months, have this kind of excitement around their product, to have this many people be engaged in it. This didn't happen, as I said, overnight, true?
True. Okay. True. And you made me sound so planful and strategic in your pre-roll. Thank you. The things that have happened in my life since like May 2007, when I first started playing with Twitter, have been entirely surreal. You know, Guy Kawasaki was someone who slammed Twitter on stage during Chris Perillo's conference, and I was watching the live stream and heard him say it, and literally was finishing up the last editing on a blog post called Ode to Twitter. So I was like, well, you know, he's wrong. Let me email him my blog post. And I pretty much thought that would be the end of it. To his credit, he not only engaged in back and forth emails about, well, what do you really mean? Why is it valuable? But then, like, I think it was 3-4 weeks later that he finally started tweeting. He wrote a blog post and said, all right, fine. Dave Weiner and Laura Fitton have convinced me I'm going to start tweeting. You know, someone at his level does not have to give credit to somebody nobody's ever heard of. And he's done it ever since. He's mentored me. He's an advisor to 140. He's really gone to bat for me. He's been a great guy. And just crazy stuff like that happened over the course of 2 years. I had no idea I was going to be in Seth Godin's book, Tribes, until the book came out and people started DMing me and saying, wow, congratulations on being in Seth Godin's book. I'm like, Seth Godin's aware I'm alive? You know, like, what do you... It's been surreal, and it really wasn't as planned out. You know, I don't know how to explain for someone else to do the same thing.
I don't mean to imply that it was planned out. I don't mean to say that a few years ago when you discovered Twitter, you said, one day I will create a directory that people will have to pay to be a part of. What I do mean is that you built a foundation on top of which many different buildings could have come. So maybe it wouldn't have been this, maybe it would have been something else, but you built a solid, solid foundation that allowed you to have conversation with investors that didn't make you feel needy, that you didn't have to go in and say, come on, I have this great idea. Conversations with Guy Kawasaki about being an advisor that didn't have to start with, hey, my name is, I love you and I've been a fan for a long time. And that's what I want for my audience. Frankly, that's what I want for myself. I think that's the way we all want to live. So let's go back to understand this evolution. A large part of it was Twitter, but what happened to you before? How did you even discover Twitter? And then we'll find out what happened that led to Twitter.
Yeah. So here's another one that, you know, kind of makes people cringe in an amusing way. May 2007, I was aware of blogging. I was aware of feed readers. I had been pretty much full-time mom for about 2 years at that point. I had done some internet stuff before then. May 2007, I turned to my then husband and I said, all right, fine. I keep hearing about Web 2.0. where do I upgrade Firefox to get it? Like, I was that ignorant. And that's when I really started blogging to rebuild my consulting business. I was a presentations consultant. I helped people communicate more effectively. I had moved to Boston between having my two kids. So I'm here in this city, basically a homebound mom, trying to work from home. Haven't really even been out with adults much in 2 years, trying to rebuild my network in a totally new city. I start blogging about Pistachio Consulting, which at the time is the presentations gig. And I start reading a ton of blogs, and I read a ton of VC blogs really early on, because presentations consulting, you know, is often working on helping someone refine their pitch. So I was always fascinated by VC blogs. So one of the most touching moments for me in the last month was both Brad Feld and Jeff Nolan, who were some of my very, very early on heroes in the blogs I read, DMing me and saying, "I'm really proud of you." It was sort of like your dad being like, "Yeah," it was neat.
You know what? First of all, I want to say something about what you said earlier, that it's going to make some people cringe. I hope it doesn't, and I don't think it will. I think what it's going to do for my audience is get them excited, make them think, all right, if she didn't know what this was just recently,
yeah,
and she was that clueless, I may not know what
yeah,
video blogging is right now. I may not know what Andrew's doing right here, but I see that there's some potential. Or maybe they'll see that there's a business going on Twitter like you're building and say, I see there's some potential. It's okay that I'm far behind. I can still jump in the game. When you were doing this presentation consulting and you saw these venture capitalists blogging, did you reach out to them and offer to teach them? Did you? What was your interaction beyond just being a reader? Why is it that Brad Feld, the famous investor, is now part of your life so much that he's proud of you?
How that evolved over time. To give him credit, Seth Levine, who works with Brad Feld in Boulder, was the first VC blogger ever to reference my material, and I didn't even have a blog at the time. So it was just I had emailed him a tip sheet of top 10 tips for VCs. For entrepreneurs pitching to VCs, and you know, top 10 rules to break about pitching. And so I always love to give him a little shout out for being the first human being to ever blog about me in any form. But yeah, over time, so I'm reading these blogs. Twitter makes its big splash April 2007. Literally, I'm 1 month into this. People are all writing about Twitter. Oh, it's so great, it's so great, it's so great. I write the obligatory Twitter's really stupid blog post. And it's really a month before I start to see the value in it. And my first use case was Ben Kosnoka, who wrote My Startup Life, really young guy in the Valley, had done a couple startups. I was seeing him tweet, oh, that he had taken a networking meeting. Oh, he had taken a mentoring meeting. Oh, he had reached out to so-and-so to have coffee. That's incredibly inspiring stuff, and that's one of the oldest business success rules, surround yourself with successful people. So that was my first, oh, Twitter makes sense. And from there, I bridged into Twitter following the bloggers I loved and realizing I could talk to them more. You know, just over time, having a lot of, you know, I think Tara Hunt uses the term accelerated serendipity, and it's a great one for what happens on Twitter. Just kind of hanging out, running into people. I ran into Loic Lemur at a video conference called PNME, the new media, it's now merged with Blogworld. And because of Twitter, was able to stay in touch with him after just running into him at the hallway, in the hallway at a conference. So I started seeing this incredible, like, oh, wow, this generates a lot of dialogue. But all I really did was just be really enthusiastic and kind of out there in earnest with what I felt and what I saw and what I thought. It never occurred to me that I was building a list or building a community or an audience or anything
like
that.
Not necessarily at that stage did you know that you were building a list and an audience, but you were methodical about something. You were trying to, if I'm understanding you right, be surrounded by smart people and engage with smart people who are doing interesting things.
Yeah, because I was starving. I mean, a mom who's home with her kids, like, it was awesome. I loved my kids, but I was starving for intellectual stimulus. And so it fed on itself. Like, I got a little taste of it, and I jumped in more. One of the reasons I got so addicted to Twitter in the first place, frankly, was I was still nursing, so I had to sit still 6 hours a day, and that's really, really hard when you're as hyper as I am.
I see. And so this gave you something you could do with just one hand. Reach out for the cell phone.
Way too much information, right? No, the laptop's sitting in front of you, you're bored, you know.
Gotcha. Okay, all right. So you're
A bet
starting
on the
to.
first entrepreneur on Mixer, do you admit to that?
No, this is what's gonna make this stuff special. I've been asking personal questions lately, and now I don't even have to ask the questions. People like you are volunteering them. All right, so let's see. You're talking to these people online. You're starting to go to conferences so that you get to meet them. What I noticed
Yeah.
was I was when I was living in Los Angeles, there was a conference, I can't remember what it was. There were several Twitter conferences, and you were at one, and when you walked down the hall, it was like a celebrity had walked down the hall, and people insisted that I go and say hi to you. And I think we just like said hi really quickly. I think I took a card or something. I don't even know if we got a chance to say hi, so don't feel bad if you don't remember. I don't even know if we did. What I do definitely remember is that there was a celebrity buzz about you, and this is before, maybe just as 140 was building. It came from building connections offline too. So you were going to these
Right.
conferences and you'd see people who were interesting to you and you'd do what? You'd go over and just say hi?
That's the funny thing is that I actually had incredible, almost the extent of social phobias about the in-person stuff. So when it started to go from the online to the in-person, I worked up gradually. I went to a few local events. I was befriended very, very early on by Chris Brogan, who obviously is a master at this game, and he taught me a ton. I started to be asked to speak at conferences about Twitter's value. The very first talk was October 2007. That's another thing Guy did for me was actually get me speaking gigs because he appreciated what I had explained to him. And he turned around and introduced me to conference organizers. He pulled me up on stage at South by Southwest. Like I found out the night before I'd be on this panel that I was totally unqualified to be on. He just gave me a chance to kind of air my opinions, and that made a lot of people follow me and come up and talk to me. And so I just learned how to, try and be friendly back. But that first South by Southwest, again, honest truth, I was overwhelmed. I don't naturally have the kind of like I think Robert Scoble has a real gift at talking to many people at once. Politicians have this gift. I really
But you
had to
were a
learn it because I
presentation
didn't have that.
consultant. You were teaching people how
Well,
to
but
give
I didn't.
presentations.
It's different from, walking down the hallway and smiling and shaking everybody's hand and feeling like somehow people should know who you are. I was really stunned to find anybody knowing who I was. I didn't think that was going to happen.
So why did
It's
they
weird.
know? Why did they know who you were? And by the way, this isn't me pushing back on you. This is a lot
Yeah.
of people who are great are also very modest. And my interviews are gonna suck if I allow you to just stay modest because people aren't gonna recognize what it is that's great about you or learn from it. So if I don't push back and say, no, but you were a
Yeah.
presentation consultant, you knew how to present yourself, my audience at the end is gonna say, why did Andrew have this schlemiel on? No, this woman's
So
great. I want you to understand why. So
I spent a lot of
go ahead.
time thinking about how to connect to an audience in the context of presentations consulting, and that a lot of what makes a presentation good is turning your message inside out and making it more about the person listening. And I did do that from pretty early on Twitter, just trying not to be totally self-indulgent. When I noticed something that I thought was noteworthy enough to remark on or remarkable enough or whatever, to try not to do it in a 100% self-serving way. And one example I give a lot in my talks is my daughter fell off a chair, right? And it just scared me. She wasn't injured. I didn't like stop and tweet before calling the ER or anything. It was a very minor fall. I processed it for about half an hour. It startled me as a mom. And instead of coming out and saying, "Oh my God, my daughter fell. I was so scared," I wrote, "What do you do when you hit a sudden fear?" And so that led to, I don't know, 35, 50 tweets back and forth with people talking about how they deal with fear. And so that tendency to turn it inside out just a tiny bit clearly led to a readership developing. I know I didn't watch my numbers very closely, but I know because of a recording that I saw recently that in October 2007, I had like 400 followers on Twitter, and I had no idea why. I'm like, this is crazy. I got 400 followers. I know because the day I met Ev Williams, I crossed to 1,000, that I had 1,000 a few months later in December 2007. And so some of the effect we're seeing is just I had a largish audience early for no real reason other than I was goofy, I wasn't afraid to be a dork. My Twitter bio forever was I make presentations suck less. My Twitter bio now for the longest time has been, that I get, much excitement and geekiness about where this all leads. I have very few filters and I'm not afraid to look like a dork. And so people relate to that, I guess. I don't know.
And now, I've had Guy Kawasaki here on Mixergy. I've seen him at conferences and had conversations with him. I don't think the guy could pick me out of a lineup if you said, "Look, here are 10 dark-skinned guys with big noses who are goofy on camera. Pick out Andrew Warner."
You
He
don't play
wouldn't know which
hockey.
one. Sorry?
I wrote to him kind of audaciously. I actually had to blow him off for about 2 weeks because he wrote back to me the day one of my daughters hurt herself and did have to go to the hospital. So I'm like, "I'm sorry, I'm dealing with a family crisis. I'll catch up with you when I can." So I don't know. I'm a chick. I was raving about Twitter. I play ice
Because
hockey,
it
and I
was
blew him
cutting
off for
edge.
2 weeks. Maybe that's what you need to do.
No, but it was also that you were onto something that was cutting edge, that you were going to teach him about it, that he was curious enough to then want to engage, and then he naturally learned from you. And I see Neil Patel do that. Somebody will raise their hand and say that online marketing stinks, you should just build a business, and he'll say, "No, let me show you how." Or search engine optimization is a big sham, and he'll say, "No, let me take you in and do it." And I think he did the same thing for Guy Kawasaki, and he stands out. And yeah, somebody's
Great.
asking, "Wow, she plays ice hockey. Did you mean that? Was that serious? You're an ice hockey player?"
Oh God, yeah. Oh, I'm a huge hockey fan. In fact, I just got verified on Twitter, and they have a bug, so it actually froze all my account settings. So my account settings say I'm still at the NHL Winter Classic at Fenway. And frankly, oh well, that was a great memory, so I don't mind leaving that. Huge hockey fan, hugely grateful to the NHL for giving me those tickets for free and for letting me skate on the ice during the Old Timers Day. First
I
time I've
saw that,
ever
by
been
the
on the
way.
field at
I
Fenway.
wasn't. Sorry, we've got this lag. I gotta stop doing interviews on
Sorry.
Twitter. I mean, on Skype. I've gotta do them in person. I did see that, and I was a little worried that maybe you weren't gonna be here because it said that you were out enjoying hockey today. But so,
Yeah.
why did the NHL, what is it, National Hockey League, the NHL, why did they give you these tickets? Why did they involve you so much?
Well, as soon as I heard about the game, I grew up in Connecticut, huge, huge hockey fan. I watched the Hartford Whalers from the time I was a kid. Gordie Howe lived in my hometown, and huge fan of the Red Sox, so tremendous passion for Fenway. When I first heard there was going to be a hockey game at Fenway, my head just kind of exploded, and I tweeted a bunch about it. And then, just through random luck, I happened to be running a panel that Mike DiLorenzo from the NHL was on at TwitterCon in DC. And I said, "Mike, I'm sure everybody and their brother are hitting you up for tickets, and I've been working angles trying to find them." And my dad actually went into the when the college game tickets were released, he spent 3 hours online trying to get me tickets. And I said, "Mike, I would totally love this, but I get it if you can't make it happen." And then shortly before Christmas, he and Gary Vee emailed me and said, "How would you like to go to the game?" And again, my head exploded. I was so grateful. I was especially grateful because they came up with a second pair of tickets that I was able to give away to support charity, because I felt a little awkward about, okay, now I have all this privilege and I'm going to this special game and na 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 na, you're not. So it was cool that they did it in a way that was very fitting with my kind of general tone on Twitter, that I could not make it entirely about, oh, look at me, I have this privilege. Although I was really grateful for the privilege.
Okay, then let's move on to what is it? I guess September 2008, you launched Pistachio Consulting. Pistachio, I should say. I think we brought it up a couple of times. That's your Twitter handle, and the name Pistachio comes from the color of your wall when you signed up for Twitter, if I'm right.
Color of my wall. I made myself a home office like 15 years ago in Pennsylvania in the attic of the house my boyfriend rented. Grabbed a can of paint in the basement to paint the roof, which was also the ceiling, which was also the walls. And it was that horrible pistachio ice cream color. So when I suddenly needed a name for my company, I went, "Oh, Pistachio Studios." And it's been ever since. So in September 2008, I took an existing communications consultancy called Pistachio Consulting and I relaunched it. And said, "We're Twitter for business consulting." And all my social media consultant friends thought I was nuts because it was so niche. But we had some really clear ideas. Marsha Connor and I wrote a white paper about enterprise Twitter products. Before Yammer even won TechCrunch 50 that year, in July and August, I spent 10 days in July going around Silicon Valley talking to people, talking to Twitter themselves, and saying, "Guys, I really think there's a need for an enterprise version of this." Social text at the time, I saw Ross Mayfield and he gave me a sneak preview of Signals and I was ecstatic because this thing that I'd been talking about since August 2007, I'd been saying there should be an internal version, was finally happening. So Pistachio Consulting was going to focus on the enterprise stuff, but there was tremendous demand for the market engagement stuff as well. So we took I took the step and relaunched, and that first quarter was horrible because all my leads were marketing companies, advertising companies, and media companies in New York City. What, 6, 7 days after I launched, the market tanked. It was exciting times, but that Wiley had by then come to me and asked me to write Twitter for Dummies, Pistachio Consulting, and just kind of being Pistachio on Twitter and having a lot of people ask me how to use Twitter. Led to this realization that there's tons of apps. Apps are really crucial to getting over the Twitter is stupid moment, and there's no central place to find them, understand them, rate them, review them, share them. So it hit me like a lightning bolt just a couple months after launching Pistachio. It was December. I was sitting in this seat in this office, and I went, "Oh my God, an app store for Twitter." And then I ran to tell my friend in another office. He wasn't there. I came back to my seat and said, "No, that's a stupid idea. Try and forget it." And then I never managed to forget it.
Wow, so you've been sitting on this idea for that long.
I only sat on it over the holiday season, and then in January I started making phone calls to people that I thought could do it for me, and I could be an advisor because I was really dead set on not being an entrepreneur. I mean, I'm turning 38 this week. I'm a single mom. I have no technology management background. I've never built software before in my life. I've never built a website outside of a WordPress blog before in my life. I felt so thoroughly unqualified to pursue the opportunity that I spent from that moment thinking about it until really until South by Southwest, trying to quit the idea, trying to get someone else to do it, trying not to do it myself. So one of the few things I give for advice to other startuppers is you have to be so stuck on your idea that you literally can't even quit it because there's going to be 1,000 times in the process that you're going to want to quit. So I think that first 3, 4 months of trying really hard not to do 140 was actually really valuable to me because it made it so clear why I was doing it, that I had to do it, etc.
Okay, before we get back into the App Store, I know that through Pistachio Consulting, you had clients according to your website like Johnson & Johnson, Ford Motor Company, People Browser, The Sister Project, Transplant One, I don't know what that is, but you had a list of clients. What kind of work were you doing for them?
The same, so for a year and a half, from the time I reached out to Guy to the time I relaunched Pistachio Consulting, an increasing part of my everyday routine was to explain Twitter to people. I literally defaulted into a position as the Twisperer. The first day I met Ev Williams, the one question he asked me was, "We find new users have a really hard time figuring out who to follow. How do we solve that problem? What are you seeing new users get stuck on?" So for a year and a half, I'm explaining it to executives. I'm speaking at conferences. I'm blogging about it. My poor presentations consulting readers were just completely overrun by blog posts about Twitter for a year. So that's exactly what I do when I'm finally getting paid for it, is I say, "Look, here's what I can offer. Here's what I can do." And of course, I was about 6 months too early on that. So a ton of time was spent just explaining to agencies. I remember sitting at one really large advertising agency in New York, and they're like, "Well, what the heck is the point?" And I pulled up, at the time it was still Sumeyes, right? I pulled up Sumeyes and I searched a couple of their brand names so they could see how people all over the world were interacting with their brand. And I say this phrase all the time. Again, their head kind of exploded, like, "Oh, there's all this consumer sentiment. There's this fire hose," everybody calls it now, of information about what people actually want and actually think. So just continuing to explain that over and over for more sophisticated audiences who actually realize they should be paying for that. And that work goes on. Marsha Connor, who co-wrote the white paper with me, still runs Pistachio Consulting for me. I still get requests all the time to help a small business, a large business, an executive, kind of coaching one-on-one. I don't get that tactical with it. But I had speaking engagements in the last year. This year I really won't be able to do them because the startup takes too much time. But the way I survived on almost no salary for months was one or two speaking engagements here, one or two advisory consulting positions here.
I'm trying to think of what of the list of questions that I wrote here for you while we were talking I should go into next. But why don't I start with this? What I'm noticing is a lot of people in the early days of Twitter were really just writing about nonsense. They were writing about the little things that happened in their lives. At the time, the top of Twitter said, I think it's what's happening or what's going on now. They were asking for
What are you
more.
doing?
What are you doing? And that's what people answered. What are you doing? But a handful of people like you were going to take it towards the business, towards businesses. How do you know which businesses to take it to? And by the way, I got to focus here. By taking it towards businesses, you were able to make money from it. You were able to make profitable contacts. You were able to make it a little more meaningful than what's for lunch. How did you know who to contact in these companies? How did you build those relationships with them that you were then able to convert into paying customers?
Yeah, I didn't. I wasn't very good at that. I had a really hard time. With Johnson & Johnson, they had a thing where Motrin trended because a bunch of moms were really ticked off about an advertising campaign. So obviously, you know, the competent thing to do was follow up and offer help. Ford, I didn't do comprehensive.
You followed up and asked for help.
I followed up and wrote to them and said, you know, and by then I had a business manager who's actually watching this. Hi, Linda. Linda Ziffrin works with consultants and analysts to help large companies understand just what they do. She was Charlene Lee's agent, and Charlene Lee was mentoring me and said, oh, you know, her. So she did some of the outreach for me. Sometimes it was direct. Sometimes it was through my network. A lot of the meetings in New York were just people I had happened to get to know. I mean, so the reason I looked at business was I knew Pistachio Consulting was getting all of its leads hands down off Twitter. And I wasn't even trying to use it as a lead gen tool. It just was. And I was getting to meet people. I remember watching the editor-in-chief of Redbook speak on stage at BlogHer. And she mentioned somebody, and she's describing how much she loves this guy, Mike, at her company. And I'm like, wait, I'm connected to Mike on Twitter. So I DM him. I said, love an introduction to the woman who's on stage right now, Stacey Morrison. She really gets new media. She gets social media. She gets where this is going. And he was in an Apple store, got my message 45 minutes later, emailed her, and I had the meeting an hour and a half later. Wow. Right? So Twitter itself put me where I got and created all this opportunity to even knock on those doors.
Wow. Wow. All right. But again, that takes some kind of thought to say, I'm not just listening. I'm not just going to tweet at them, hey, great presentation, but I'm going to ask for an introduction. I think there's value in understanding how people like you work, because I think I wouldn't think to do that. We're all living in our own little world with our own way of doing things, and I like to see how others do it. All right. What about this? You mentioned earlier, you said you were, quote, thoroughly unqualified for the idea, and Kupret Singh, who's watching us live, says there's no such thing as unqualified. Maybe. But what I'd like to know is, once you decided that this was an idea, 140, an idea that you were going to pursue, and you didn't have the technical skills to build it yourself, what's the first thing that you did?
Begged for money.
Really?
To people who didn't want to listen. Another thing you said in your pre-roll was like, yeah, you never had to beg for money from people who didn't want to listen. Oh, yeah, I did. Mm. You know, the feedback that came back, well, this is great, but you're really more the CMO, you know, who's going to run it, who will be the CEO. One of the first co-founders I reached out to was really more of an operations guy, really more of a COO than anything else, because I was kind of freaked out just by the idea of running a company. I didn't feel I was running Pistachio Consulting that well. I was struggling there. Luckily, he didn't work out, because what I needed the most was a CTO type. I needed developers. So I shifted my focus and started looking for developers. Couldn't find them. What eventually saved it for us was getting So I started raising on my own in earnest at South By last year. So that's mid-March. My first actual pitches, I think it was right around tax day, April 16th. So it was a couple weeks after South By. No, the first actual pitch was around April 1st. And the first actual meetings out in the Valley were around April 16th. And it took me about 10 weeks to raise the angel round. And it was raised on enthusiasm, a PowerPoint deck, no demo, no product, nothing. I was trying to talk somebody into being my co-founder. I was trying to talk a developer into hacking together, some kind of prototype. I just kept pushing on many fronts all at once. And for 10 weeks, all I did was ask for help, ask for money, ask for advice. Again, I was coming into this with a pretty privileged network where I could sit down with VCs in the Valley and ask for their advice. But, you know, as much as I love those guys, most of them still haven't invested in the company at this stage. They've just been there for me. The old thing about ask for advice when you need money and ask for money when you need advice. I was asking for money. I got lots of good advice. the two things that finally moved the momentum in the right direction were getting into Techstars back in Boston and convincing Pivotal Labs to start coding, even though they knew I didn't have very much of my angel money in yet. So I guess before that was convincing a couple of angels to start investing. But when you're doing a startup, and this is why you have to be so hell-bent that you're not going to quit, people all line up along a starting line, and you can feel them coming together. You can feel that they're starting to believe in you, and they're going to move at some point, but they're all waiting for somebody else to take that first step to break the plane of that starting line. And I could feel that so tangibly, and it drove me so nuts. And finally, when people started to, it's dominoes start to fall, and it makes a huge difference. So over the course of mid-April through mid-May, was trying to get that momentum. Like I said, by May 11th, I had begged Rob Mee at Pivotal Labs, you know, look, I will give you this initial upfront payment. Will you please start developing? He said, look, wait till you have the money in the bank because I may have to stop your project if you don't get the money. I'm like, I don't care. Go, go, go. I have, you know, daycare needs. I have family travel plan needs. I have speaking engagement needs. If we don't start now, I'm going to be in a bad position, you know. So I begged, and he started, and that made more investors come in, and then the investors coming in made other investors coming in, and it finally got to critical mass around the end of May, and we closed around June 10th.
How'd you get in front of the angel investors? Was there somebody who shepherded you through the process, somebody who made introductions?
So I just started, I was very aware that it was easier to get to angels in the Valley than Boston. And I had, again, a baseline, really solid network in both cities, more of a network out west than in Boston, just because my network had been gotten through social networking and there's more people doing that out west. Even then, it was sort of, you know, I would see that an angel type event was going on Twitter and reach out to some of my friends that I saw were in attendance and say, hey, by the way, remember, I'm looking for angel. I had one advisor, Dan Martell. God love him. He has been with me throughout this whole process. He was an advisor of mine at Pistachio Consulting because his startup, Spheric, in Canada had done some enterprise microblogging type stuff. He was one of the first people I told the idea to, and he would introduce me to other angels because he's an angel investor. He committed. The funny thing about angels, you know, they commit, they disappear, they come back. It's definitely herding cats. My first day out in California when the build started, because Pivotal requires you come and stay there on site with your engineers. I remember Rob Mee saying to me the first day, like, yeah, you know, you have these angels, they're all committed. You have five lined up, ready to go for X amount of money, but you know, they're gonna act like dudes. Some of them aren't gonna call you in the morning, right? Some of them aren't gonna follow up. Some of them are gonna back out. Some of them are gonna come back in later. And just being able to kind of keep plugging away at it. When the tide shifted, my lead angel, mad thanks to Combe Lagoue of Nueva Ventures, he happens to be Charlene Lee's husband, and she, as I mentioned before, had been mentoring me for quite a while. She was one of the people I saw was at a investors networking kind of an event, and I said, hey, I'm in town next week. I need to meet some angels. Please keep an eye out for me today. At that event, she emailed me and said, oh, you know, you should really meet this guy, and he had this funny name, and I didn't make any connection. It's actually her husband, right? So all I knew was having coffee with some guy named Combe, and that was all I knew. And as I got into town, I was on the phone with Charlene. She's like, yeah, that's actually my husband. I'm like, oh, he turned out to be our lead. He's active with the Harvard Angel Groups in San Francisco. So once he was aboard, he did definitely go to other angels and bring them in. But
what
was it
about
you
that convinced them? What was it about you or about your story that convinced them to invest?
I think that I was, you know, honestly, I know what it is because the relationships helped me get the meetings, but it wasn't helping me get the results. The fact that I just kept going, the fact that no matter how much I got turned down or no matter how much they weren't really sure, I was still moving the company ahead. And this is one of the few things, again, that I think it's useful to hear about my story if you're working on your own startup, because most of my story you can't replicate, right? But don't lose sight of spending so much time raising that you're not spending any time moving the company forward, right? So while I was spending all this time trying to get these meetings, I was also pushing on getting a developer in place, getting a CTO in place, getting the coding started. And I kept pushing on different things. And so an investor would see me over the course of a few weeks, and there'd always be progress, right? It was always closer to happening. And they need to know you're going to do this with or without them. Because people want to invest in things, you know, they want to put their money where it's not actually needed in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they feel your desperation and they know there's no way, I mean, I would sit in Rob Mee's office and say, if Twitter for Dummies ever makes any money, I'll give it all to Pivotal. And we start coding based on that. And he's like, you know, you're just always pushing on something to see what will move forward.
And Pivotal is one
and,
of these shops
and I think
that
that's what,
they... Pivotal is one of these shops that essentially creates startups. What they do is they're like, I guess there are different shops like that throughout the country. Like in Los Angeles, there's Citrus Bite that a lot of people use. They take an idea, they build a site for you, they train your people on how to manage it, and then your people go off and they run the business. And that's why they wanted you to have a tech person in place, and that's why they wanted that person to be in their office with the idea that eventually that person would be responsible for the work that Pivotal gets going. And somebody in our chat room
and they
is asking,
literally,
sorry, no, you go
they
ahead,
please. They provide help hiring your tech people. You know, the CEO, Rob, sits down and pair codes with any developer you think you're going to hire. They had product management expertise. They provide essentially free office space as long as you need it. If I ever wanted to hire an employee in San Francisco, I could just set them at Pivotal until it makes sense to set up an office out there. So it really is profoundly an incubator, less so than shops that say, all right, well, give us your spec and we'll deliver code in 3 months. So a lot of the pushback I got from investors was, you're choosing the most expensive possible shop to get this developed. But for me, being totally non-technical and having no technical team, if I had gone to a more outsourcey dev shop, the product would have been a disaster. I needed a vendor that could teach me how to build a website. And that's what Pivotal did. And same thing with TechStars.
What did it cost, they're asking in the chat room?
I'm sorry, what?
What did it cost? What was the cost, they're asking in the chat room?
We ended up, Pivotal's about, it's really expensive. It's about $15,000 a week for a pair. And so what we came up with was, look, you don't have much money. You know, generally their startups are more seed funded than angel funded. But we came up with this idea that if we do a 6 week run, and he gave me a very slight discount, so like a 6 week run was gonna be $84,000. We could get a minimum viable product up and launched. We could move the development offshore if we had to, or maybe I would have a technical team by then. So that was the approximate budget. Over time, they got more and more faith in me, and they kind of sent favors my way here and there, like, oh, we have a new hire. We don't normally charge clients for our new hires, so we'll have them work on your project. And so we ended up with a 12-week run for the price of a 6-week run. So again, your mileage will vary. But the most satisfying thing was by October, Pivotal had so believed in what we were doing that they came on board as investors. And so the very last amount of fee that we would have owed them in cash, they took in paper. Every startup comes to them and asks them to take paper up front. They can't do it because everybody's asking. But if you work hard and you prove yourself and you show them that you're gonna really do it, you know, and that's true no matter who you're trying to get, employees, vendors, investors, just prove them that no matter whether they're involved or not, you're going to do it. That was the single one thing that brought people in alignment and brought them on board with doing it.
And when you said 15,000 a week per pair, that's because they have two developers work on one screen. They do pairing, as it's called, that I'm learning more and more
about.
They
do pair coding, agile, extreme programming, and Ruby on Rails.
Okay, how did the TechStars figure into all this?
Oh man, my luck had been ridiculous. Very early on, December 2007, my friend invited some of her friends over to my house, Hallie Suit, who's a blogger from, you know, the original cohort of bloggers. And one of the guys she invited was Dan Bricklin, who literally invented the spreadsheet, right? And she told me this. Oh, the guy who invented the spreadsheet's coming over this afternoon. I didn't really believe her because that seemed a little absurd. I hadn't lived in Boston long enough to get that, Boston's full of people like this. So Dan, Bill Warner, who founded Avid Technologies, again, you may have heard of, non-linear video editing, the guy created it. I had gotten to know those guys over time on the local Boston scene. Diane Hessen, who's the CEO of a company here called Communispace, I'd gotten to be friends with them. They were all going to bat for me, trying to get me angel meetings, and I still couldn't get a single angel meeting in Boston. Boston's angel community is getting there, but it wasn't there when I needed it. And I remember coming back to the Techstar guys. I was formally rejected because they don't take sole founders, and I was a sole founder. I came back to them and I said, look, I'm getting all this traction out in the Valley. I'm getting actual angel investors. I think I have a shop lined up to start coding it, but I'm getting no love in Boston. Can you please help introduce me to angels? Because I don't know what I'm doing wrong. And it just happened that slots had opened up at Techstars. Companies that had been accepted didn't take it. They saw that Pivotal was actually developing. They saw that some angels were actually coming in, and they said, all right, we'll throw our chit in too. We'll believe in you. And that was incredibly important because it's literally a classroom format where they're telling you all the stuff you don't know. You have a huge problem as an entrepreneur, especially if you're as inexperienced as I was, where you don't know what you don't even know. You don't know what you haven't thought of yet. And so that structure was important. That vote of confidence was important to the starting line effect I was talking about earlier. I could then go back to investors and say, hey, I'm a Techstars company. Hey, Pivotal Labs is building the prototype. People, you know, I'm real. People believe in me. I'm real. This is happening. And of course, it's us now. But after so many months of being a sole founder, I say me and I too much.
Maybe here in this conversation, but on the website, it's much more than me and I. I see lots of names on there and lots of Twitter handles. And you know what? And a lot of them...
Thousands. If you really list everybody who had something to do with the startup, it's easily 300, 400, 500 people.
What about this? A lot of people on the website and a lot of times in this conversation, a lot of people on the website are listed as advisors. A lot of times in this conversation, we talked about your advisors. You mentioned the word mentor a couple of times. Seems like you've got a nice support system and it's pretty formal. You ask people to just be your mentor and well, how do you do it? How do you get a mentor?
Every single one has come in differently, right? You know, how do you get Guy Kawasaki to be your mentor? We sort of talked about how that just sort of happened. I asked him formally at South by Southwest. We already had the relationship. I asked him formally to invest. He turned me down, but said, I'll be an advisor, right? And so that was like one little bit of social proof. Hey, Guy Kawasaki is my advisor. Other ones, one of my absolute best mentors, I've often described him as being my entrepreneur's shrink, is a guy named John Prendergast, who I literally just walked into an open coffee one week and met him completely by chance. He has given me, you know, at least an hour of phone support every week since when I met him, and is now on our board as the independent, which is awesome because he's so aligned and helpful and knows my strengths and weaknesses and can yell at me when I need to be yelled at. So everything from, you know, reaching out to a rock star like I did with Guy to just running into the exact right person at Open Coffee and everything in between. The Techstars program is heavy on mentoring. I'm unafraid to ask for help. I'm unafraid to admit when I'm clueless. I think that helps people feel like, well, my mentoring would go somewhere if I spend some energy talking to her about what she needs to know because she's actually listening. One of the people I talked to very, very early on and kind of tried to outsource the startup, I went back to him later in June and I said, you know, I could sort of see the point when we were talking where you really kind of lost faith in me as a CEO. So give me some brutal feedback on what your reservations were, what my weaknesses are, and what I should be working on. And he's like, Laura, honestly, the fact that you can even ask me that question means you're fine. Because he's like, most entrepreneurs are these hot-headed 25-year-olds who are like, I know the world, I have no weaknesses. He's like, he's like, I'm totally impressed with what you've done, you're gonna do fine. But you know, it took some courage to go up to somebody you know had lost faith in you and say, hey, why'd you lose faith? And that's one of my goofy talents.
It seems like that's a talent. Also connecting with people, asking them for support is a talent of yours.
Thanks.
Did I lose you? Oh, you don't want to agree with me, but...
Okay.
All right. So I was wrong in the beginning of the interview when I assumed as an outsider that the funding just happened easily for you. As an outsider, somebody who had even done research from the outside, I still didn't get a picture of how hard and long a process it was.
Everything since June has been a cinch. We closed a second tranche of Angel at the end of October, mainly because of people who mentored us through Techstars who wanted to invest. One thing I learned, the week after the round closed, the June 10th round, which was convertible debt, I was trying to raise $140,000 to be cute. It ended up oversubscribing. I think we closed about 227. Like the very next day, a Techstars mentor said, "Oh, I wish I'd been in the round. I didn't realize you were raising." And I said, "Oh, well, we've closed it, so next time I do a round." Closings are not that cut and dry, it turns out. So I played the like, "Oh no, if it's closed, we can't do it." And we later did a tranche in October. Again, we thought, well, we think we have 50,000 in interest, so we'll open up to about 100,000. And we shut it down at 135 because we were going to dilute. We plan to raise our Series A this spring, probably March 20, 2010 was the objective. But I had a really outrageously lucky chance to go to a meeting on the Boston innovation scene that Steve Ballmer was had come to town, and it was 12 people briefing him on what's going on in Boston. So when one startup ends up in a room as the only startup with four VCs, that's where you want to be. All four VCs essentially turned to me and said, "Let's have coffee and see what you're up to." And it was less than a month between that random meeting and having a term sheet from Flybridge Capital. They essentially just came in and preempted the round. And that saves us. Fundraising is so exhausting for a startup. Going on a 2-3 month thorough roadshow is tremendously draining on the entrepreneur. It distracts you from the stuff you need to do to build the company. So we were insanely lucky to get a really solid VC, really good terms, and have it all preempted and happen very fast. I think we signed the term sheet November 13th. We closed the round December 4th. So things, that's how to do it, right? It's to not need it and have someone who wants to put it in. But I don't know how to tell you to replicate that.
All right, let's go into the audience and take some of their questions and see what they have to say. Globetrooper is actually saying, he's quoting you as saying, "Everything since June has been a cinch," and he's saying it's good to see that kind of frankness from an entrepreneur.
Yeah,
Andrew SG.
fundraising-wise. I mean, the other stuff wasn't easy, but yeah.
Yeah, and leading up to that was definitely not a cinch from what we're hearing. Andrew SG, who's always such a great participant here in the chat room, is asking, any examples of what you didn't know that you learned at Techstars?
It would be hard to point to any one given thing. I learned a lot more about how metrics work. I mean, remember, I knew nothing about software or websites going into this. Every moment of anything I've done, I've been learning massive amounts. The other big help with Techstars was breaking through that inaccessible angel and startup community in Boston, which at the time, even though I had great introductions, I wasn't making headway with. By the end of Techstars, it was much more well known what all nine teams were doing, and the kind of the Boston Angels knew who we were, knew what we were up to. I also saw a question in the chat room about press. Again, not something you can replicate. Before I even had the 140 idea, I had been in Forbes, I had been in USA Today, I had been quoted in the New York Times. Press were finding me on Twitter because of Twittering about what I was doing. And the same as when I said Pistachio Consulting got all its new consulting leads from Twitter, all that press, the first outbound press I ever did was Brian Solis, who is an advisor to the company and just an amazing publicist, the press he did around our launch. So everything else, that Entrepreneur Magazine thing, 2 years worth of about 60 national publications, were people who heard about me word of mouth. Clive wrote me up in the, or quoted me in an article he did in the Sunday New York Times Magazine ages ago. It was August 2008, right? And so press begets press. The press opportunities have been crazy to explain because it's just, I don't know, they just keep coming and they keep asking. And Jenna Werthmann called me in the middle of the whole Haiti thing to say, "You did some early fundraising for charity on Twitter. I want to know what you think about the texting thing." So that's another thing where my personality is not as good at self-promotion as people assume it is. So if it hadn't been happening in on a gravity basis like that, where people were coming and finding me, there wouldn't have been nearly as much press. And clearly the press helps too, just from a credibility angle.
It also helped that you were outspoken about about a site that people were curious about and that was also growing and gaining popularity on its own, and people needed an expert to go talk to.
Yeah, I mean, what if I had gotten addicted to, you know, no disrespect because I love the team behind Pounce, right? But what if I had been a total Pounce addict and advocate, right? I just got lucky.
Yeah.
I staked my entire career on Twitter in May 2008, right? So long before Oprah, long before Ashton. It was a gut feel. I could have been so wrong about it. I got lucky.
A lot of people are asking after Pivotal, after the investors, what share of the company was left for you?
It's more than I need, right? It's one of the few upsides of being a sole founder. But yeah, it's, you know, you get diluted. We're already all pretty diluted. Been pretty generous with our employees. You know, no one else is technically a co-founder, but we try and give them co-founder level amounts of stock because we all should own part of something much bigger if we really want to win than owning more of something that doesn't really go anywhere.
So you're a minority shareholder at this point, right? Fair to say?
I'm under 50%.
Okay. All right. So what's the future for 140? What's the vision?
Well, you know, we have a lot we still want to learn, just the stuff we thought we'd have the luxury of focusing on quietly, about product market fit, about, you know, why would somebody come back? Why would you go to an apps marketplace when you don't actively need an app? So one example, you pointed out that if someone writes a review, they essentially get a comment bar on the app's page, and that's good exposure for them. If you're a social media consultant or a heavy user of Twitter and you're always hearing from people, I see someone in the chat room right now saying, I want to know what apps she uses. You can go to 140.com/pistachio and see what apps I use and see what I've written about those apps. So if you're a social media consultant or people are asking you all the time, just your activity on our site, adding an app to your collection or writing a review or rating something, all gets pulled together at your profile page. Which, by the way, you can also use as a Twitter landing page. By that, I mean the thing you're going to use in your URL on Twitter itself. Because it's really helpful to people deciding whether or not to follow you to land somewhere that's not just the homepage of your blog or the homepage of your website, but somewhere that says, oh, hi, you just clicked my Twitter profile link. Here's who I am. Here's where my stuff is online. Here's how I use Twitter. Here's whether or not I follow back. Here's some Twitters I think are great to follow. So we let you, if you want to spend the time and dig into your 140.com/your Twitter username, because we preserve the namespace, profile, you can dig in and say as much as you want to there. And with one click of a button, you can make that your Twitter URL and use that to send people to the places online that you are present, that you want them to know about. So, you know, we try and make it user-friendly. We try and make it easy for developers to shine, to put up press mentions, to get their stuff found. But understanding, you know, we put tons into search, and search still needs a lot of work. I'm not thrilled with our search results. You know, that's something you're always, always trying to improve when you're inside the app searching. But we're learning just by watching users, they don't really care that much about search, or a very small percentage of them do. They'd rather see the app sorted in different ways. So when we launched e-commerce last week, we relaunched our homepage. De-emphasized the list of top 10 apps because that was getting way, way too much attention, and it's not even a really valid thing because Twitter apps are so diverse. Changed how we present the idea of essentials, because we're not saying this app is essential. We're saying here are the 10 categories of apps that most people find essential. Most people want to have a desktop, a mobile, a link shortener, a way to share graphics. And, you know, we eventually want those to circulate so you're not seeing just the number one app in each category, but the top six. More emphasis on searching by platform, searching by category. And we have a ton of different ways to sort and help people discover that are in the pipeline that will be coming out. I mean, I think at this point we're, if you know Twitter really well and have some idea about Twitter apps, we're pretty helpful. If you just flat out saw Twitter on Oprah and didn't really use technology that much, I think you'd have a pretty hard time getting what we're doing, right? So we're building towards that mainstream audience. We're building towards the audience that reads Twitter for Dummies, for example, you know, the book that we wrote and that. So that's where we're going with it. And also just understanding what developers need the most. Because if we are not a place that a developer can come and build their business and really have all upside, then we're not doing our job. Like, we're never going to be Apple wrangling them in and tying them to restrictive clauses and trying to be mean about it, right? We just genuinely have to offer something that's useful to them, or they're not going to have any reason to want to build on our platform.
All right. Well, actually, you're right. Several people in the chat did ask what your apps were, and I kept meaning to ask you. But of course, we should do what Globe Trooper did in the chat, which is just link people to your list of
yep.
apps on 140. So it's 140.com/pistachio.
Yep, and that's actually right on twitter.com/pistachio. That's my URL too. So in case you forget that or you want to find it again. And the nice thing is, you know, you want to see what apps Chris Brogan uses, you just type 140.com/Chris Brogan. We've locked into the Twitter namespace so that your name on Twitter is your name on 140. You don't have to worry about someone taking your screen name. It's a little tricky because Twitter lets you change screen names. So if you change screen names in between visits to 140, you may need our help resetting your account and getting you back in.
But most people don't
do
that.
And
you're right.
Right.
What I appreciate is that you didn't do 140.com/user/Andrew Warner. Just /Andrew Warner.
Right.
Make it easier for me.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. We know how people can get a hold of you. They're going to go over to 140.com/pistachio, or they're going to say hi to you on Twitter directly. A couple of things that I often ask people who I interview, and I sometimes do it after the interview, but we might as well do it during. First is,
okay.
Several times here you said, you guys can't copy what I did necessarily. And I don't want to copy the people who've been here, but I want to learn from them.
Sure.
I want to find out from you who else we should learn from. Who else out there would you want to copy, or would you learn from, that I should bring on here an interview about entrepreneurship?
Oh, well, you've already interviewed most of the people who I find really inspiring. You know, it's for everybody, it's very personal, isn't it? Right? It's who gets you fired up, whose message really, really resonates
with you.
Is
there someone for you
who
fires you up that people don't know enough about?
So you had to add don't know enough about, right? So I can't say Gary Vee, I can't say Chris Brogan, I can't say Seth Godin.
I'm going to say then Chris Brogan. I've been thinking of interviewing him, and I haven't actually reached out, and I'm going to ask you for an introduction. All right, great. And the second thing is, now that you've been...
Crazy busy. I emailed him the other day, I DM'd him to invite him to my birthday party here in Boston on Thursday. Anybody out there in Boston, come on out. I'll be tweeting the link. We're going to Kingston Station. It's a charity for well wishes. You can support Haiti with it if you want, or you can contribute towards building wells in the third world. His travel's crazy, man. He's in like Bogota right now, and then tomorrow he's in Chicago.
I never push. It took me Guy Kawasaki. I think I'd been emailing for 2 years. Somebody wants to know why I don't have Guy Kawasaki yet. I've interviewed him. I think 2 years of back and forth where I'd invite him to speak at conferences, where I'd invite him
right.
to do different things, where I'd ask him for an interview, where he finally just said, yeah, you know what, let's do it, Andrew. So I'll email Chris, and if he's not ready now, and 2, 3, 4, 10 years from now he'll be ready, then we'll talk to him then. The second thing is...
Well, some other...
Yes.
Let me give a shout-out to the New England startup scene.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really awesome people here. David Cancel just announced, you know, Performable. I don't know if you've interviewed him before, mm-hmm. but they just got $3 million in funding. They're here up on the North Shore of Boston. Angus Davis, after a very successful exit, has moved back to Providence, Rhode Island, and is a tremendous anchor for the Rhode Island and Boston venture communities.
Sounds like a perfect person for me to interview.
Yeah, and there's some great stuff happening here, and I don't just say it because I want to see the Boston startup scene take off so that 140 can always be here, but there's some really great things going on. I'm excited what Techstars did. Of course, I love Brad Feld to death. He's been so insanely generous with his time and advice. Just some cool people, yeah.
I've been getting a lot of requests for an interview with Brad. I'll have to email him too. All right, finally, you've now gone through the whole Mixergy treatment. What do you think?
You were kind. Thank you. I was nervous.
You didn't come across nervous, and I'm really glad that you are on here. I've been wanting to get to know you and find out a little bit more about your background, so thanks for being here and answering all these questions.
Yeah, no problem, no problem. One takeaway thing that I don't think I ever said, and it's important. One of the most important things that influences my life was a mistake I made when I was 17. Was sitting at home, my parents were away for the weekend, I had a passport, I had about $450 in my bank account, and it occurred to me as I watched the Berlin Wall get torn down, because yes, I am that old, that I really wanted to dance on top of the wall, because that was such an emblem in my childhood of hate and oppression and the fact that the Russians were going to nuke us at any minute and people were being shot in no man's land. Like, psychologically, that was huge, seeing that wall come down. I thought about going. I called the airline. I had the money. I could have gone. And ultimately, I didn't. And about 6 months later, I told someone the story. And he's like, you are crazy. That's a gift that stuff like that occurs to you to do. He's like, most people don't have the idea, right? So they don't go because it never occurs to them to go. If you're having ideas like that, you have to act on them. And that really, you know, like, because I screwed up and didn't go to the Berlin Wall, I have a very strong bias to action. When an idea comes to mind, and maybe it's a little goofy, but it's not going to hurt somebody, and you never know what the result might be, but it'll probably be interesting. I think 9 times out of 10, I do commit and say yes and do it. And that one thing has definitely opened a lot of what's happened to me, just being able to scan the horizon and see when the luck occurs. Like, my superpower is I'm lucky, but yeah, it does help that I'm probably looking for it maybe more than most.
Wow, wow. That's such a great place to end it. I actually wrote myself a note. I'm going to see if I can excerpt this somehow. So thank you for coming here. This will hopefully not be the last time that you will come on Mixergy. And thank you guys all for watching. I keep asking for feedback, and I keep getting great help from people in the audience, both in the comments and the emails that they've been sending me. So freaking helpful. So even though it seems needy for me at the end of all my interviews to say, guys, what do you think? Give me your feedback. I'm going to take it, and I'm going to say, I want your feedback, guys. Come back to Mixergy or shoot me an email.
It's
let me know what
needy.
You think.
It's not needy. It's about the audience.
Thank you.
Awesome interview, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Right on. Bye, everyone. I'll see you in the comments.